The following are the Navy logs for the week of April 18th, 1983. Navy log number one in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to Navy Log. The Navy is not the only society interested in the use of drugs by our Navy's young people. Correspondent Vicky Calambaro reports on a survey of young people across the nation.
Marijuana use by America's youth has declined over the past few years. According to a survey done by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, there was a 3% decrease in marijuana use among high school seniors between 1981 and 1982. Overall, there's been an 8% decrease since 1978. 60% of the students surveyed recognize a great risk in the use of illicit drugs. An increase in disapproval from peers has also been an attributed factor in the decline of drug usage. Despite the decrease in marijuana usage, the current-day drug problems still exist. Roughly two-thirds of all American young people try some form of drug before finishing high school. More than one-third admit to using drugs other than marijuana, and at least one in every 16 high school seniors uses marijuana daily.
Thanks, Vicky. Here's a group that doesn't need drugs to gain altitude. Journalist Donna Burke filed this report on a group who used to be on the roof.
Starting in 1928 and continuing for the next 13 years, a very select group of radio men were taught how to intercept the secret Japanese Katakani telegraphic code. These classes were so secret, they were taught on the roof of the Navy Department in Washington, and the members involved came to call themselves the On the Roof Gang. Captain Hal Joslin, and an original member of this group, talks about those days.
When we went through training, secrecy was of the utmost. No one knew such an organization existed except for us who were trained and people in CNO. It came under the auspices of CNO. And we were trained, and it was a very, very secure organization. We never even spoke about when we were getting orders, where we were going, anything like that at all. Matter of fact, it was so secret that we wore regular radioman rating badges. We weren't CTs. We didn't have a distinctive badge at all. And then we were sent into the field to intercept communications of the Japanese.
The cryptologist rating, with its own special badge, was finally established during World War II. This June 17th at the Naval Security Station in Washington, a memorial will be dedicated to the original On the Roof Gang, the nucleus of what has become the Naval Security Group.
Thanks, Donna. Here's another group that's worked at even higher altitudes. Correspondent Tom McCullough reports the latest from the Chief of Naval Education and Training.
Six men who helped naval aviation span the years from open cockpits to the carrier flight decks of World War II will be inducted into the Naval Aviation Museum's Hall of Honor at the Pensacola Naval Air Station on May the 12th. The new inductees this year are Marine Corps General Roy Geiger, a leading combat general of World War II and the fifth Marine to earn his Wings of Gold, Mr. Glenn Martin, pioneer builder of many aircraft for naval aviation, Admiral Mark Mitzer, one of the leading carrier admirals of the Second World War, Vice Admiral Charles Rosendahl, the prime proponent of lighter-than-air craft in the Navy, Admiral Arthur Radford, a World War II leader and first Navy officer to become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Commander Elmer Stone, the first Coast Guard aviator and pilot on the famous transatlantic flight of the NC-4 seaplane in 1919. Ceremonies honoring the six new inductees will be held at the Naval Aviation Museum. Special groups of lighter-than-air pilots and Coast Guard officers are expected to take part in ceremonies on May the 11th, when the museum will open two new exhibits showing the history of Coast Guard aviation and lighter-than-air naval aviation. This is Petty Officer McCullough for the Chief of Naval Education and Training, Navy Radio News.
Thanks, Tom. Just mind your P's and Q's, and maybe you'll one day be inducted into the Correspondent Hall of Fame. Mind your P's and Q's is a statement we've all heard before, but do you know where it comes from? Back in the old days, when sailors were paid a lot less than we are now, seamen used to drink in taverns that would extend credit until payday. Since most sailors were illiterate at that time, the barkeepers would record how many pints and quarts of ale each sailor consumed, and it wasn't uncommon for the record keepers to add on a few extra ales that were never drunk. A sailor had to keep his wits about him and mind his P's and Q's. We'll mind ours till next week. Maybe you had better, too. Until you join us next time on Navy Log. For the Navy Radio News Service in Washington, with journalists Vicky Calambaro and Donna Burke, this is Bill George. baby lug number two follows in 3, 2, 1. Welcome. Money and entertainment are the issues in this edition of Navy Log. A bill extending the granting of selective reenlistment bonuses is the subject of this report by correspondent Donna Burke.
The selective reenlistment bonus is once again in effect, giving some Navy men and women a greater incentive to stay in the service. Lieutenant Commander Dave Hebden of the CNO's retention office has more.
On 30 March 1983, the President signed into law a bill which extended both the selective reenlistment bonus and the enlistment bonus programs through September 1984. The extension of the authority to pay bonuses is the result of Navy, Congress, and the administration's support for programs to recruit and retain personnel in critical skills. The SRB and EB programs have been vital to the effort to reduce petty officer shortfalls as the Navy moves towards a 600-ship Navy. This legislation does not modify the existing SRB or EB programs by affecting eligibility or award levels. However, the extension authority does provide much-needed stability to these critical programs. Details of the legislation are contained in NAVOP 3283.
This bill extends the granting of SRBs until September 84.
Thanks, Donna. Correspondent Vicki Calabara filed our next money report on how to borrow from the Veterans Administration.
11 million homes have been purchased with the help of VA home loan guarantees. Spokesman from the Veterans Administration, John Hickman, explained some of the history behind the home loan program and two men in particular, the first man and the 11 millionth person to buy a home through VA.
Almost 39 years after a World War II veteran signed for the first home loan under the GI Bill, Vietnam-era veteran Robert L. Phillips will become the 11 millionth veteran who has received a credit boost from the Veterans Administration to help in his home purchase.
According to Hickman, more than 4.9 million World War II veterans have benefited from the home loan program. Almost 3 million Korean and post-Korean vets used the program, and about 2 million Vietnam-era vets have utilized the home loan entitlement. In recent years, the Veterans Administration has also added some things to the program. Loans for condominiums and mobile homes and lots are available, as well as grants for disabled veterans needing special living arrangements. And there's no time limit for using a home loan entitlement. More information on home loan guarantees is available at your nearest VA office.
Now for the entertainment, I promise you. Correspondent Tom Berryman reports from California for the upcoming season of the Navy's flight demonstration, Blue Angels.
A man from Tennessee talks a lot about the Navy's precision flying team, the Blue Angels. Lieutenant Curtis Watson is the narrator for this show season. Next year, he moves into a demonstration spot. Lieutenant Watson feels no apprehension about the maneuvers.
We build a margin of safety into each of our maneuvers by doing it exactly the same way every time we perform the maneuver. We spend 2.5 months every year fly over 120 practice shows before we do our first demonstration. We don't start off flying at minimum wingtip to canopy separation. They start out wide and high, moving in closer and lower as they start to feel proficiency in this type of flying.
Satisfaction, it comes from the people he works with.
The maintenance crew is the elite maintenance crew of the Navy. They are some of the best. The officers, too. Again, everybody is hand-selected for this team, and it's just the caliber of people has made this real enjoyable for me so far.
For the 32-year-old Watson, most demanding is keeping up with the pace.
We're on the road anywhere from 270 to 300 days a year. In order for us to put on a professional air show that people expect to see, things have got to happen, and they've got to happen quickly and precisely.
The 7.5-year veteran feels being a pilot is the top.
Flying airplanes to me is one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done in my life, and I can actually say that every morning when I get up and go to work that I look forward to whatever we're going to be doing that day.
Lieutenant Curtis Watson of Crossville, Tennessee. For the Navy Radio News Service, I'm Tom Berryman.
For the Navy Radio News Service with journalists Vicki Calabara and Donna Burke in Washington, this is Bill George. Navy log number 3 in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to this edition of Navy Log. Children, everything goes into their mouths. Correspondent Vicky Calambara reports that technology has given them something new but deadly to taste. Grab a pen. There's an important hotline number coming up.
Approximately 500 to 800 button-sized disc batteries are swallowed every year. Those figures come from recent reports from the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission and the National Capital Poison Center at Georgetown University. Spokesperson of the Safety Commission, Ann Scher, said that due to technical advances in the electronic field, smaller batteries are increasingly available in homes. They're found in watches, calculators, cameras, hearing aids, and games.
Although the vast majority of these button batteries, when accidentally swallowed, will pass through the person without any problem, occasional severe complications and even fatalities have been reported. Batteries may become lodged in the esophagus or intestine, slowly leaking alkaline electrolytes and causing an internal chemical burn.
If someone does swallow a button battery, treatment information is available, but prevention is the best possible solution to the problem.
Recommendations to help prevent button battery ingestion are: 1. Keep button batteries out of your child's reach. Discard them carefully. 2. Do not allow children to play with button batteries. 3. Never put button batteries in your mouth for any reason. They are slippery and easily swallowed accidentally. 4. Always check medications before swallowing them. Adults have swallowed batteries mistaken for tablets. 5. Caution hearing aid users to keep hearing aids and batteries out of the reach of children.
Additionally, if a battery is swallowed, contact your poison control center, physician, or the National Button Battery Ingestion Hotline by dialing 202-625-3333.
Once again, that's 202-625-3333. Thanks, Vicky. Here's another example of modern technology. Donna Burke reports,
what's round, 6 inches in diameter, weighs 3 pounds, and orbits the Earth? It's a grapefruit. Actually, that's the nickname Nikita Khrushchev gave a small American satellite back in 1958 when it was launched into space. Officially known as the Vanguard 1, it was designed by the Navy, launched by the Air Force, and tracked by the Army. Since Sputniks 1 and 2 and the Explorer 1 have all fallen out of orbit, this little grapefruit is now the oldest artificial satellite to orbit the Earth, as well as being the first to operate on solar energy. Before its radio stopped transmitting in 1964, the Vanguard 1 proved the Earth to be pear-shaped, not round. It also corrected ideas about the atmosphere's density at high altitudes and improved the accuracy of world maps. U.S. space surveillance systems still track the little sphere, and current estimates have extended the life expectancy of the satellite for another 2,000 years.
Thanks, Donna. On the sports scene, an All-Navy Wrestling Championship was held recently in Pensacola, Florida. Then the winners went on to represent the Navy in the Inter-Service Championships in Quantico, Virginia. At Quantico, T.J. Jones placed second in the 105-pound freestyle competition and first in the Greco-Roman contest. Guy Zanti placed second in the 114-pound freestyle class, and Clint Yale placed third in Greco-Roman at 114 pounds. Rob Herman placed second in the 125-pound freestyle competition and won the Greco-Roman title. 136-pounder Arnie Koch won the freestyle competition and placed fourth in the Greco-Roman contest. At 149 pounds, Frank Hernandez placed second in Greco-Roman, and Jim McGrath placed third. Dave Butler won both freestyle and Greco-Roman titles at 163 pounds. Representing the Navy at 220 pounds was John Doloff, and in the heavyweight category, Mike McGuire. Both of these gentlemen placed fourth in both categories in their respective weight class. Notice I said gentlemen, you two. Sirs, with that, we'll close this Navy log. For the Navy Radio News Service, with journalist Vicky Calambara and Donna Burke, in Washington, this is journalist Bill George. Navy log number 4 in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to Navy Log. There are many one-parent families in the Navy, and correspondent Vicki Calambaro reports that they are now banding together.
A nonprofit organization called Parents Without Partners, or PWP, now has chapters on military installations. Ann Parks is the Director of Information for PWP. She describes what the organization is all about.
At the national level, we are interested in, of course, legislation and the condition of single parents generally. At the local level, there's a personal contact between members and their children who join through different kinds of activities. And these kinds of activities are in three categories. First, they're educational activities. Lectures, discussions, seminars, things of that sort that promote sharing of similar backgrounds and interests and experiences of members. Then there are family activities where single parent families can share low-cost fun with one another. And it's really fine for the kids because they get to see other single parent families having fun and don't feel so isolated or unique. And then, of course, there's social activities where members can interact on an informal level.
If you'd like to start a PWP chapter on your base or command, write to Parents Without Partners, 7910 Woodmont Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, 20814.
Moonlighting is not why the man in the moon is up there. It is something that many military men and women do. Correspondent Donna Burke filed this report on that subject.
Many men and women in the service take second jobs in their off-duty hours for a variety of reasons, but mainly to make more money. The pros and cons of moonlighting by military people have been debated for years. Most people in supervisory and command positions are opposed to the practice because they feel it lowers the efficiency and diverts the energy needed for a person to do their military job well. On the other hand, many others feel that the extra training is a boon to the service and that military personnel might leave the service if they're not allowed to take an outside job. If you decide to moonlight, remember that some commanders have issued local regulations concerning a second job, and it's wise to ask your commander what the policy is before seeking or accepting an off-duty job. In addition, the Department of Defense prohibits certain activities. You cannot use your rank or title in connection with any business or for endorsing any commercial product. You cannot have outside employment that interferes with the performance of your military duties or use inside information for personal gain. The DOD directive does encourage service members to engage in teaching, lecturing, and writing, but all information to be used must be available to the general public.
Thanks, Donna. In the war-torn country of Lebanon, people do without a lot of things, but not if the Chief of Naval Education and Training has anything to do with it, as Tom McAuliffe reports from Florida.
The city of Pensacola and the Navy Marine Corps Partnership teamed up recently to put some sweetness in the lives of Marines deployed in Beirut, Lebanon. Pensacola Mayor Vance Wibbs and Pensacola City Councilman Howard Ryan and Norman Fritz delivered 160 pounds of hard orange candy to Colonel Richard P. Bland, commanding officer of the Marine Aviation Training Support Group aboard NAS Pensacola. The candy, all 17,280 pieces of it, was later put on a flight bound for Beirut. The request came from a Mr. and Mrs. Albert E. Shively of Pensacola, who received a letter from their son, Marine Major Al Shively, who is stationed with the 1,200-man peacekeeping force in Beirut. He requested that something sweet be sent so that he could pass it out to Lebanese children. The candy, which was paid for by the city, helped show how proud all of Pensacola is of the Marines in Lebanon, according to Mayor Vance Wibbs. He said it will also help perpetuate the people-to-people image of the American serviceman abroad with candy in his pockets. This is Petty Officer Tom McAuliffe, CNET Public Affairs for Navy Radio News.
Thanks, Tom. If you're coming back from Lebanon or any foreign country, just listen to this. Clearing customs with prescription drugs doesn't have to be a headache. The U.S. Customs Service has some tips on how to make things easier. When traveling overseas, take only the medicine you'll need for the trip. Carry prescription drugs in original containers and take along a copy of your doctor's prescription notice. Check your medicine bottles for accurate labels and make sure your name and the U.S. origin of the drug are on the label. Taking a few minutes to check your prescription drugs will probably speed up the customs inspection when and re-entering the U.S. And with that, we'll close this edition of Navy Log. For the Navy Radio News Service, this is journalist Bill George. Navy log number 5 in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to this edition of Navy Log. It has been decided on Capitol Hill that the Labor Department will aid veterans. Correspondent Rob Chastain reports from the Capitol.
An additional $200,000 has been allocated by the Labor Department to provide job training and placement services for unemployed veterans. Labor Secretary says the additional funds will provide skills training and help in finding jobs to some 5,000 veterans through pilot projects in 4 states. Secretary notes that the funds will be used by 2 state governments and 2 city governments to establish pilot projects that will prepare the Labor Department for the upcoming start of a national veterans program under the new Job Training Partnership Act. The states of Alabama and California and the cities of Buffalo, New York, and Seattle, Washington will receive the additional funds. This brings to $500,000 the total amount for the expanded veteran job training and placement activities. The Labor Secretary states that he is concerned with the services provided to disabled and Vietnam-era veterans who have been hardest hit during the current recession. Rob Chastain, Washington.
Thanks, Rob. Fraud, waste, and abuse has been emphasized as a major problem by the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger. Correspondent Jerry Lambert reports on 2 Champus fraud cases in San Diego.
Champus claims processors and Defense Department investigative agencies uncovered 2 fraud cases in San Diego. In the first case, the former manager of a San Diego medical office was sentenced in federal court to 18 months in jail for filing false Champus claims. The manager admitted receiving $26,000 from the fraudulent claims in more than 7 years. The office manager was placed on 5 years probation and was ordered to repay the $26,000 to the government. A San Diego clinical psychologist was accused of receiving more than $65,000 during the past 5 years from filing false claims with a local Champus claims processor. The claims were for services never rendered, services already paid for by other health plans, and for services provided to ineligible patients or given by ineligible providers of care. It was also determined that the psychologist forged the signatures of patients on many of the Champus forms. He is to be sentenced soon and could receive up to 10 years in prison, an $11,000 fine, and be ordered to pay $75,000 to Champus and a private health plan company. I'm Jerry Lambert.
Thanks, Jerry. You know, part of your military benefits package includes being able to shop and save at commissaries and exchanges. Personnel are always talking about getting a better deal at this or that store, so correspondent Vicky Calabara decided to ask someone about these special deals.
A question often asked about commissary stores is, why don't they have special sales like civilian supermarkets? Master Chief Ralph Stevenson of the Navy Resale Services Support Office, or NAVRESO, cleared up that question. Navy commissary stores do have special sales. Most stores have regular savings events in the meat and produce departments every week. There are also seasonal sales throughout the year.
We're even putting more emphasis on sales in the commissary stores. That was one of the items that the Fleet and Force Master Chiefs recommended at the June Symposium in 1982, that we need to have more sales and put the word out about them.
Commissary sales aren't widely publicized because the stores aren't allowed to advertise. However, most stores do put out flyers that can be picked up in the store for your shopping and saving convenience.
Thanks, Vicki. The U.S. Navy Nurse Corps celebrates its 75th anniversary in May of this year. The Corps was established by an act of Congress on May 13th in 1908. The first only duty station for the nurses in 1908 was at the U.S. Naval Hospital in Washington, D.C. The main duties of the first nurses were general nursing care and the training and supervising of hospital corpsmen. Today, there are approximately 100 duty stations for Navy nurses. 22 of those duty stations are overseas and onboard aircraft carriers. The duties of naval nurses practices have expanded also over the years to include clinical specialization and expanded nursing practices such as anesthetists, practitioners, and midwives. Traditional responsibilities are also a big part of the Navy Nurse Corps of today. May 13th is an important day for the Corps and the Navy, marking 75 years of professional nursing care. With that, we'll close this edition of Navy Log. In Washington, with journalists Vicki Calabara and Donna Burke, this is Bill George.